If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of a deal. But are you getting the deal and cash back? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love, savings, and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Levi's, Plow & Hearth, Adidas, Sephora, and Neiman Marcus. Stack sales on top of cash back and feel what it's like to know you're maximizing the savings. And it's easy to use. And you get your cash back sent to you through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app or go to Rakuten.com to start saving today. It's the most rewarding way to shop. That's Rakuten. Rakuten.com.
All right. So, lords and ladies, boys and girls, friends and enemies, we are here once again with author Nat Cassidy, who I'm not going to do the three-hour intro for this time around.
I had to stop someone at an event. The phenomenal bookseller at Books Are Magic, Tiffany. We were at an event, and there were two other authors on the panel. And I looked over and I saw how big the bio she had for me, so I had to interrupt her in her mid-introduction, which was very rude of me. But we would have been there all night. So I'm glad. Yeah. I'm glad you won't.
Or, you know, the short version, you know, actor, musician, and author. So
works for me.
The short and sweet version. All right. You have been on here before, so I'm going to try to not give you all the exact same questions, mix it up a little bit. First one that I'm currently asking everybody now, what is your supervillain origin story?
My supervillain origin story. Let's see. I was exposed to gamma radiation in a lab accident, and at the same time, I was bitten by a spider, and I was also raised in a very boring environment in Arizona. The latter one is probably more accurate. I don't know if I explicitly have one, because it's just sort of a I'm assuming this is in the context of being a writer. It was just always something I was doing as a kid, and I was always, you know, I was raised in the desert, and we didn't have a lot of money, and we lived far away from everybody, so all my friends were kind of too far away to hang out with when I was a kid, and I was a latchkey kid, so I was home alone, and so I was just like fighting a constant battle of entertaining myself. And pretty quickly thereafter, I started writing stories and attempts at writing novels. I very early on became a massive Stephen King fan when I was like 8 or something like that. And I just started aping his output as best as I could. And it had just always been a thing that I was drawn to do. I guess the only other thing that competes with that is that I was also a very precocious little child actor around the same time. I started acting when I was like 6 years old. And similarly, I was just like obsessed with storytelling, and I was obsessed with performing and, conveying sort of make-believe to other people. It's a challenging thing to have an origin story for when I literally have no memory of a time when I wasn't engaged in it as a sort of desperate defense against dealing with reality.
I thought you were going to say against boredom for a moment there.
It's six of one, half dozen of the other, you know. It's this, life could be very boring, and it was not something I was prepared to deal with.
Oh yeah, no, and I get it. For those who don't know, Nat and I both at different times obviously grew up in the Phoenix area, and Phoenix is one of those cities that just doesn't build up, it builds out. Mm-hmm. So it's super easy to be even really far away from the people in your same school.
Yeah,
because the school boundaries are huge.
Yeah, and I lived outside of the district, so I was even farther away. Okay. Like, we got special permission to go to the school that I went to, because yeah. I was one district away. And so I should have gone to a different school that was actually much closer, but it wasn't as good. So yeah, everyone was like they might as well have been in a different state.
Yep, totally. And once upon a time, Phoenix did have those areas, though, too, that were not filled in yet. I mean, I told you I went to Paradise Valley, but when I lived there in the late 80s,
yeah,
we had a trailer home park, and the only closest thing, there was a 7-Eleven on the corner. If you go to that same place now, it's surrounded by malls and everything else, but growing up, there was nothing to do.
So I forgot we had this in common. Paradise Valley was the high school I grew up next to. So I grew up on 32nd and Bell.
Yep.
And we were literally, like, by that point, I the way I describe it is we weren't on the wrong side of the tracks, but we were basically on the tracks. Because on, like, the other side of 32nd and Bell was that nothingness that you were describing. Mm-hmm. Like, we had our, like, strip mall, and we had our movie theater and a used bookstore that was kind of an oasis for me. And then on the other side, it was just, like, nothing. It was, like, a used car lot and Trails, the leather shop Trails, and, like, you know, a couple of things like that. So it was, like, you know, I know exactly what you speak, because that was it. Like, there was just nothing but desert and, like, lots that were being sold at some point.
Yep.
And for a good chunk of my adolescence, too, in high school, this will be very fascinating for anyone who doesn't know the area. But the 51 highway was being built while I was going to high school. So that entire intersection was just construction and impossible to navigate. So people couldn't even, like, drop me off comfortably. And I would just have to, like, walk down either 32nd or Bell in just the nothingness, in the 115-degree nothingness.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I walked home from school one time, and that was actually a 6-mile walk.
Oof.
And I was in district.
Oof.
My car had broken down, and it was my senior year. I had, like, a half day.
Oof.
It's like, I can either sit around here for 4 hours or I can just start walking. So
yeah.
I'm not sure I beat the bus home by much, to be honest with you. Yeah. It's a long, boring.
Yeah. I used to have to take the city bus to get to high school, and I would have to wake up at, like, 4 a.m. and then go sit at the bus stop, because it came once an hour and it was, like, a different time every hour. And you just had to catch the one that showed up. Not the best metro transit at the time.
At least it was the coolest part of the day. I'll give it that much.
It was nice and cold.
All right. So let me ask you a question for people who are interested in Nat Cassidy, outside of necessarily being an author, but also as an author. What does a day in your life look like?
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, it's interesting because it's kind of in flux at the moment. I've been, I left after 15 plus years at one particular job, but also just, like, having a day job my entire life. I've never not had a day job, but at the beginning of this year, I left it so I could just start writing full time. My wife wound up having some really bad medical complications and surgery, and then complications after the surgery. And we were, like, living in the hospital for a month, for basically all of February. I've been, you know, caretaking her while she gets better, which she's doing much, much better. But it basically means I quit my job to write full time at the beginning of this year. And I've barely been able to write, like, a word all year. So it's not the most accurate depiction of what a day in the life is usually like. But in theory, I usually wake up and, like, you know, I still have that habit of waking up before dawn to catch the city bus, as it were, even though I am not a morning person at all. I hate it. But I'll wake up usually around, like, 6 or something like that. And, you know, I will mainline coffee for basically all of the AM hours. I'll try and, like, write from, like, 6 to like 9. Then, you know, currently then I'll, like, you know, help my wife with whatever she needs and stuff like that, and get her food and get her ready for the day. But, you know, ideally then I would do the same thing for myself and then come back and write. I tend to run out of steam creatively around, like, 3 p.m. I just kind of can't put words together anymore. So then I would probably focus on, like, emails and administrative stuff like that, go for a walk. I don't know about you, but, like, one side effect from Arizona developmental years as I am like a fresh air addict. Like I have to have some time outside. I'm like a lizard on a rock. Like I just need to like soak up some sun. So that's always kind of necessary. And then I try to be done by like 6 or 7 so I can have like dinner and family time. And then I usually get like a second wind, a second creative wind around 10 and, you know, try to do like an hour or two if I can. And that's about it.
So it sounds like you quit your full-time job for a full-time job.
Yeah. That was another like weird thing for me is that I have always been used to working like 3 full-time jobs at a time, like full audition load, usually rehearsals for something else or filming something else, and writing every like free second that I would scrounge up. That was the same for when I was a playwright. I would write on, you know, the commute, trying to figure out how to write on the subway. And then I would find like an hour or so at the office to write and stuff like that. And so it was a massive shift for me to be like, oh, I'm just, because for me, it felt like I was quitting my day job to just like fuck around. And I was like, no, I got to remember, I still have so many other full-time jobs to do that I've just been used to squeezing in whenever I could. Now it's just like, I have like one less full-time job.
You don't have that whole Richard Castle, I carry around $2,000 on me all the time thing going on yet.
I don't know. Should I start?
I always feel like that gave a bad showing of authors on what they could actually expect in their lives. All right. And then, so let me ask you, I've got one, we'll get to the book in a second. I got one more question I did want to throw at you. Say somebody asked you, it's like, you know, Nat, you're getting blurbs from like, you know, Tanner Reeve and King and Hill and all these guys now. We'd like you to just teach a course at the university. What do you think that you would want to teach on, or just what piece of advice would you want to give them? And it doesn't have to be necessarily writing skills. It could just be something about authorhood is a business unto itself.
That's very true. I love this question. I've always wanted to teach. I think I would enjoy teaching very much. That was always kind of, that was the thing that my mom really wanted me to do and go into. And weirdly enough, when I first moved to New York, I moved without really any money other than like a very small, like almost stipend, tiny little scholarship that my university was able to give me. And then I, so for work, I had to find a job really quick, and I was going to do SAT test prep. Like I moved here, and then like the next day I had like a training session at Kaplan. They made you like put together a lesson about anything you wanted it to be. To like give as part of your like job application, and you had to do like 5 minutes of a lesson. And so I chose to do a lesson on Shakespearean scansion. So I can teach that really easily, verse scansion and all that. But I would love to teach a course on like on Shakespeare or on like the horror elements of Shakespeare. I could talk about that all day. Or kind of horror literature in general. I don't know if I'm the best person to speak on like the business of being an author, because I feel like every day I am constantly realizing there's more I need to be doing or should be doing. I would love to take a class on the business of being an author. I really enjoy like reading my friend's work and giving notes and stuff like that and receiving notes and stuff like that. And I really enjoy like acting lessons, giving acting lessons. And, one of the other things that I do a fair amount of is direct. And I love looking at directing, not as a dictatorial sort of enterprise, but it's like, all right, let's make this thing together and let's kind of like figure it out together. And like, you know, it's my job as the director to be the audience surrogate, essentially, but, you know, usually with an artistic point of view, of course, but to also just like talk about how things are landing for someone who's not in the production itself. So like, I love that dynamic for teaching as well, of just like, let's figure this thing out. I don't know if I'd be really good at like, you know, education under like college level, because I don't really know. It would have to be that kind of like Socratic sort of dialogue together, and I don't know if that's necessarily the most productive way to like teach arithmetic, but maybe. I don't know. I've never tried it. Hey, so I'll teach anything.
Give me a lesson plan. Who knows? All right. So I had a lot of questions as I was reading your book, but then I read your afterword, and I don't have any questions
because
you answered most of them. However, that would make for a really short interview. So I'm probably going to ask you some questions I already know the answer to. But this book, and again, I kind of popped this up teasingly because you had actually mentioned Stephen King at the time. But, you know, he's already come out, horror, terrific, published Sink Your Teeth Into a Classic. Stephen King calling it a classic.
If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of a deal. But are you getting the deal and cash back? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love, savings, and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Levi's, Plow and Hearth, Adidas, Sephora, and Neiman Marcus. Stack sales on top of cash back and feel what it's like to know you're maximizing the savings. And it's easy to use. And you get your cash back sent to you through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app or go to Rakuten.com to start saving today. It's the most rewarding way to shop. That's Rakuten, Rakuten.com.
You are allowed to talk, to pat yourself on the back there for a second. But what was the, you know, we were on when you had Nestlings come out, and we kind of talked that about being a haunted house story. Mm. If you boiled it down, yeah. Obviously it's more than that. This one, and I think it's no secret based on the name, is a kind of a werewolf story, but, and you'll have to read it. I'm not giving away everything, but it's not, and it is, it's definitely, it's got some twists and turns. What was some of the inspiration for this book?
I really wanted to tell a story that was at once a chase narrative that had, you know, a very well-defined structure and a sort of propulsive, what would you call it? Dynamic, I guess, a propulsive. The very nature of a chase story is one that is like de facto propulsive. Because it's so primal and simple, like thing chasing you, gotta run, get away. So I really wanted something that could be boiled down to that sort of simplicity, while also then trying to tell as complex and knotty, you know, knotty with a K, sort of character study about fear and about anxiety and about you know, the complicated status of fatherhood, fatherness, you know, the relationship between father and child and between child and father. So I really wanted it to be something that could at once be very aerodynamic and streamlined, but also leave room for these moments of, you know, for lack of a better word, because this sounds very up my own ass, and I don't mean it this way, but like profundity. I wanted there to be some depth to it. And so like one of the big influences that I was specifically drawing on, you know, I could easily go into the many Stephen King books that that helped inspire that, because I think those are exemplars of this, like Firestarter, like Rose Matter. Those were very much influences, but like the biggest influence that that really instructed me and helped me see what I was trying to do was Terminator 2, which is, you know, just like a perfect action movie. I adore that movie, just on a technical level, on a thrills level. It's just such a great, you know, sort of simple story of a killer robot chases a boy who will save the future and is saved by another killer robot. But the movie also makes so much space for these, you know, investigations of what it means to be a mother, what it means to survive trauma, you know, with Sarah Connor carrying over all of the heaviness from the first movie. And, you know, her relationship with her son is so fraught and complicated. And also, like, is fate immutable? Are there things we can do to change the course of history that we know is going to happen? Are we our future mistakes, in the case of Miles Dyson, and even in the case of the Terminator himself, who, like, it sucks that this is kind of always going to be spoiled, especially if you watch this interview. But like, Arnold Schwarzenegger as the good guy in that movie was itself just like such a narrative coup. He was the bad guy in the first one. There's even like some fake outs early on that he's still the bad guy in the second one. And he's not. Like, there's so many rich thematic things going on in that movie. Can a machine learn what it's like to be human, even? And, you know, is humanity doomed necessarily? So I loved that a story could be a genre vehicle and a, you know, a just like a thrill a minute sort of spectacle, but also leaves so much room to have you never stop thinking about the questions it's bringing up. And that it's not like a bonus. It's as important to the experience as a semi truck crashing through the overpass of the LA reservoir and things like that. Like, it's great.
Nice. And by the way, unlike your book, I feel like Terminator is probably past the spoiler alert section of its shelf life. I think we're fine on that.
It was 1992, people. Come on.
Yeah. Yeah. If somebody's watching this going, man, I was going to watch that tomorrow, they're lying. It was not going to happen.
Also, it's worth it, even if that's all spoiled.
Yeah. I do have to say there's a couple, and again, I'm going to avoid spoilers like the plague. I always do on something like this, especially since your book isn't out yet. There were a couple of things, but only a couple, that I kind of figured out along the way. And maybe that's when you expected us to figure them out. Maybe it's not. But by the time you got to the end, I was still like, I didn't see that coming. I see where you hinted at certain things and you foreshadowed them. And I can connect the dots easily, but I did not see the dots on the way. And I think, to be honest, that is probably a perfect way to write a story.
Hey, thank you very much. Several twists, and I think that comports with kind of what I was hoping for. Like, there are a couple of twists that are very like lowercase t, like, you know, if you see this coming, that's fine. Like, it's not meant to be just like a mind-blowing reveal or something like that. Like, they're very clearly hinted at from the beginning, but then ultimately where the story wraps up is something that hopefully you don't see coming, but gotcha. Feels inevitable by the end.
I think this is non-spoiler enough if I word this way. I figured out the werewolf origin pretty early on.
Yeah.
I did not figure out the bat origin until after it was already being explained to me. Like, halfway through the explanation part, I'm like, wait a second. you got that one. That one went right by me. Very, very well done.
Hey, thank
also,
you.
If anybody, I always say this for like all of the book clubs out there, because I know book clubs kind of hover at that 300 page mark. This is under 300 pages. So if you want a horror story for your book club, this is going to be right up your alley.
It's true. It moves fast too.
It does. I'll be honest with you. Not to toot my own horn, I've just been overly busy. This time last week, it's not out yet either, but I had Schwab on, B. Schwab.
Well, that's amazing.
So I have been reading, and my last couple books I had to read were like 500 plus pages.
Yeah.
So I finished up your book today, but I really only got to put 2 days into it.
Yeah.
And I read over half of it today. So, you know, 150 pages minimum. And it just went right through it. It's like, it was an easy read. That's, you know, again, I always tell people that's not a bad thing. Some people think they want to, and I was like, if the book doesn't make me pull out the thesaurus or the dictionary, I don't want anything to do with it. But but it drew you along as to the fact that I'm looking up and I was like, I'm like getting like 10 pages away and I'm like, oh, some time has gone by. But yeah, absolutely, absolutely love this one. And again, I'm not going to argue with Stephen King, who said it's an instant classic. I don't have the review up yet. Obviously, I just finished today. I don't think it's going to be a surprise for anybody. It is 5 stars.
Thank you.
That's all I literally couldn't find anything bad to say about the book. usually you can find a chink or something. It's like, you know, I like the book, but you know, maybe it was a little too long. Well, that didn't happen. Maybe I didn't like a specific character, but even the characters, every single one of the characters in this book had a purpose.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. I also love, some people, you might be crazy about this. I also love the fact that there are certain things that are just simply not explained. And I think that is 100% acceptable in a horror story.
I agree. There's got to be like a little bit of mystery to, at least around the margins of things.
Yeah.
Otherwise it's just like an instruction manual.
Yeah, let's not be giving anybody ideas on how to do some of the stuff you brought up.
Yeah, that's true.
Now, obviously, I kind of breezed through the afterword. I did see some of the stuff about like your dad and things like that. Anybody who's reading the book, read the afterword. The dads in this book are not the dads that he grew up with. You know, that doesn't mean there might be inspiration here or there, but it's not him. But where did Cookie come from? And also, by the way, Cookie and Uncle Pepsi, were you really, really hungry when you were writing this book?
Always. I don't have a day job anymore. I'm starving.
True.
I'm starving. Please feed me by buying this book, please.
Exactly. But what was the inspiration for Cookie?
It's funny. Cookie, in part, came from a real person. For those who haven't read the book yet, Cookie is our main character's mom. And she's a very sassy, kind of fun, eternally young sort of stage mom, kind of, but like the good version of a stage mom. Mm-hmm. Very supportive, very much believing in her daughter. Jess is our protagonist, who's a sometimes struggling actor in L.A. And Cookie just loves her kid. She's a huge fan of her kid and thinks her kid is fun and a hoot, and they like to, you know, go out and party together. And she's just like an eternally young sort of supportive maternal figure. So she came from two places. One was a friend of mine from college who's actually like quite a successful actor and is just a delight, and she's incredibly funny. She does a ton of like improv and stuff like that. She's no real relation to Jess, but she has a mom named Sugar, who is a frequent character on her Instagram and stuff like that. And I just like see them hanging out all the time. And I just love that dynamic so much that I was like, I'm gonna echo that a little bit, because that is delightful. And she just seems like a super cool person to hang out with. So I just couldn't get that dynamic out of my head. I also I wanted to tell a sort of stage mom dynamic, but like the healthier side of it. Cause you know, this isn't a book about, toxic motherhood the way like Nestlings could be. This is about toxic fatherhood. So I wanted the mother figures to actually be, you know, really not cliche supportive, but just like people who are there in ways that their children need them to be there. And also I really wanted, I don't know, I'm trying to think of a way to describe this without it sounding like overly cynical, but like, I really wanted another like Aunt Nadine type character. Like I just missed that sort of energy. Aunt Nadine is a kind of the fan favorite character of my book, Mary. And she's also just like this sort of, doesn't give a shit, woman who's, you know, smoking, Capri cigarettes and, you know, always has like 9 very compound insults ready, at her beck and call. And I just enjoyed writing her. So I wanted like a character like that. But I wanted the sort of sunnier version of her, not like, not the miserable conspiracy theorist that Nadine can be, but just like a fun sort of almost insult comic of a woman at times. So yeah, that's where she came from.
And I love the point that you, or the fact that you pointed that out, because when you started to say she was a stage mom, I want to make sure, and you already mentioned it, but the thing I was going to point out is it's not the, you know, dance moms or anything like that. It's not, yeah, it's not that type of stage mom. She'd be happy for her daughter if she doesn't, but if her daughter does make it big, she's also going to be telling everybody, yeah, that's my daughter.
Yeah, exactly. She, some of those aspects are based off of, you know, how supportive my mom was, or how supportive other acting friends' parents were, you know, just like little, yes, embarrassing or cringeworthy gestures to you when it's your parent, but then especially once your parent is gone, you realize how supportive that was and how wonderful that was. Like having headshots hung up in the house. Like my mom had several of my headshots hanging up in her house, and it was so embarrassing. It was so stupid, but like she was just really supportive. She loved to kind of broadcast to the world, like, this is what my kid is doing, and. You know, Cookie does that, or Cookie like is thinking of all the times where she drove Jess to auditions and wasn't like managing her, micromanaging her, like telling her how to audition, but like was just there to drive her places when she needed to be driven. And I think stage parents like that deserve a shout out as well. So that was the attempt.
Well, and I love her relationship too. The relationship with her and Jess, even in this, Jess is the main character. I don't even know we said that. Jessa is the main character. Their ability to like basically be yelling at each other, and you know, basic, because this is a me thing. I try not to cuss, but basically, it's kind of the version of like, you know, thanks you bastard or whatever. Like, but they're not taking offense at it when they're cussing at each other.
Yeah.
I thought there's like, this is a way to handle that in a healthy way.
Yeah.
It's like, yes, I know you're stressed. You can be mad. You can vent your anger out, but I'm not going to hold against you what you said. I'm not going to hold it against what you said when you were hungry.
Right. No. Exactly.
And the fact that they're comfortable enough that they know they can say these things and that the other person's still there for them.
Yeah.
So it's also a beautiful picture of a relationship.
Yeah.
However long that relationship lasted.
Yeah, and it's very much meant to serve as a kind of counterpoint to the complicated paternal relationships that are rampant throughout the story. Every character basically has a complicated father relationship. So there needed to be some stability for, you know, Jess's wholeness as a person, too. Like, she needed a strong figure in her life like that to have the wherewithal to deal with some of the things that happen in this book.
And I do have to say, you actually mentioned it early in the book. Was it an improv team? Sorry, I read it so fast. There was a group that Jess was a part of, and they'd called their stuff like Daddy Shoes, which is
yeah.
a takeoff of Daddy Issues.
Exactly.
Which I think also probably would have been a really good title for the book, but also might have got the wrong people picking it up. So I understand. this is much more horror themed. Also, without going into spoilers, this is not just a werewolf story. There are other very, very horror things going on in here. And without spoiling anything, what you did to that second nurse was just uncool, man.
Hey, she didn't enjoy it either.
No. That's the one that got into my head a little bit.
Oh, good.
You know, everything else you can kind of see where like you could fight it off. What happened to her? I got nothing. I got years of therapy and sending you the bill. That's what I got out of that one.
Yeah, I really love to like sit and think about like how that must have felt.
That was a great for being such a short part of this entire book.
Yeah,
that was, for lack of a better word, a great scene.
Oh, thank you.
I could see that in a horror movie, and just yeah. All right, getting to the point now where I'm trying to avoid spoilers as much as possible. Anything you want to say about the book that we haven't brought up that, you know, just kind of whet people's appetite, but without me saying anything that I shouldn't be saying?
I mean, I think you have hit the nail on the head in a perhaps circumspect manner, which is appreciated, by saying that this is and is not a werewolf novel. It is perhaps more accurate to describe it as a shapeshifter novel. The mechanisms of the shapeshifting are part of the exploration of the story, I would say, or of the plot. But it is, again, part and parcel with the theme of father and fatherhood, which is, as I go into in great detail in the afterword, kind of a mercurial, mutable role I have found in my relationship with my dad and his relationship with his dad and many other people I know's relationship with their fathers as well. It is a very shape-shifting kind of relationship. And so that is the reason why it is and isn't a werewolf novel is because I also wanted the role of the werewolf to not be a static thing or to be a predictable thing. So if you don't like werewolf novels, you might enjoy what this does with the werewolf trope. And if you do enjoy werewolf novels, you might enjoy what it does with the werewolf trope.
But I 100% agree with you on that one. I can't gush enough about this novel.
Thank you.
Yeah. Does have a little too much cussing for me to give it to my mom, but so do most books.
It at least it warns people right off the bat with the first part.
Yes,
I love giant letters.
It's almost like I've got a trigger warning for trigger warnings. It's coming up. That part was hilarious. I love that. That was right off the bat. And I'm just reading through that list and then how you described it at the end. I'm like, okay, yep, Nat's still got a sense of humor.
I sure hope so.
Oh my goodness. By the way, also, this isn't a spoiler thing either. The ending of this book. I love the way you ended it. This book very much hints that there may or may not be more coming up, but I also would actually not want to read a sequel to it because B, I don't know what you do with a sequel.
Yeah.
But also the fact that it comes back to the fact that I also think this is the best ending of this story.
Thank you.
It did not need to be wrapped up in a nice little pretty package. And it was perfect that it left you going, does this mean or does this mean?
Yeah.
Which I love.
Yeah. I am very, very proud of this ending. I'm very fond of it. And it's been interesting too, because I have heard from like two camps of early readers, one which finds it to be a almost unshakably disturbing sort of ending, like it is like a gut punch sort of ending, and then people who complete opposite are like this was like a very cathartic and hopeful ending, and that I couldn't ask for a better sort of response to have both of those, to have like this is the bleakest, most depressing ending I've ever read, or this ending was cathartic and hopeful. Should be impossible, but I'm very glad that those two responses.
And again, the way you wrote the ending, I think they're both right.
Yeah, exactly.
It's
exactly.
What you read into that ending.
It's different for me each time I've read it. Like I think I wrote it from a more nihilistic place, and then in the rewrites, kind of found ways to, you know, depending on the way you hold it up to the light, to see something different. Again, with that sort of shape-shifty sort of feeling.
It's like, what's that movie where the coin's spinning at the end? It's like, is it going to fall?
Yeah.
Anyhow.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. So I love Nestlings. I love this one better, if that says anything. Definitely, I'm going to do a review. Actually, I already did a review for it. I just haven't put it out yet because I was having you on. And then, yeah, it's everywhere I put it out. I'm telling people to read this. There will be a book review up, video up for it as well. Also telling people to read this. glad that you didn't drop it on, you know, Halloween this time. So it's got time to be got picked up there. But yeah, if anybody who has a horror-themed, like, book club, or is just a horror fan in general, should be picking this book up. This has got to make it into your list. That's all I'm saying. And I'm not, you know, Nat is already on the channel. I don't have to say these things.
It's true.
I will have to say, though, that this video is not sponsored by Good and Plenty.
That is a shame,
because I can read the book.
I can eat that by the bucketful. So if you do get a sponsorship, I would like a cut of the proceeds.
Santos, however, though, I don't think felt the same.
Hey, I think he's learning to enjoy it. You know,
he's learning to not hate it. I don't know if he's learning to enjoy it.
Yeah. Well, you know, got to begin somewhere to have that arc, right?
Yeah. But I just love some of the descriptions of that. And I'm like, huh. I'm not sure those guys are pulling up to your door with a pile of sponsorship money just yet.
I messed up. Then. There's a character who introduces Good and Plenty's to this character named Santos. And he describes them as... accurately, that there is crushed up beetle carapaces that help make the dye, the pink dye. And he says, I don't know why, but that always makes me crave them even more. And I'm the same way. Like, every time I hear that factoid, it should be disgusting. And I'm just like, man, I really want some Good and Plenty right now. I really want to feel that.
There's people that spend way too much money for coffee because it went through a cat's butt. So, you know.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. And I love coffee, but I'm not there yet.
Yeah, I'm not looking out for that one. I can't guarantee I've never actually. I could probably guarantee I haven't had it because it's probably the most expensive.
Yeah, I would hope you would know.
I'm just hoping whoever's got that job is making at least minimum wage wherever they're at.
Yeah, I hope they get gloves at some point.
I hope you replace these strainers every batch. That's all I'm saying. Okay, so let's go ahead. We've talked about everything I think we can talk about on a 300-page book without giving something away, because I'm so close on a couple of things, and I keep them like, go to say something. I'm like, nope, don't say that. So wrapping it up, what are you reading right now, if you're reading anything at all? I know you've been super busy.
Oh, man, what am I reading? I don't know why my mind always goes blank when I'm asked that question. I am currently...
As long as the back of your neck doesn't start itching.
Yeah, right? Stop right there, though.
Yeah,
it's a hard book to talk about. I feel your pain. Let's see. I am listening to the audiobook of Stephen Graham Jones's newest, The Buffalo Hunter Hunter, which is phenomenal. It is one of the best audiobooks I've heard in a long time. So I should mention is When the Wolf Comes Home. That also has a phenomenal audiobook. That if people like audiobooks, they should definitely check out both of them. I'm rereading The Dead Zone for the, I don't know, seventh time, and just finished rereading Needful Things for like the fifth time or something like that. Those are both in preparation for the book that I'm currently writing, which are take influence from both of those books. I just finished Brian McCauley's newest, Breathe In, Bleed Out, which is a total delight. I am reading Haley Piper's new short story collection, which is Teenage Girls Can Be Demons Too, I believe is the title.
That does sound familiar. I think
I've heard that. Yeah, which is also fantastic. I'm a huge Haley.
Great title, if nothing else.
It's great. It's a great cover, too. I love the cover with the title. What else? What else?
You're as bad as I am. What are you reading? Well, let me tell you what five books I'm currently in the middle of somewhere.
Yeah, I will have the books that I'm reading in hard copy, which are usually like ARCs that have been sent to me. And then I'll have the books that I'm listening to, which is usually like one fiction and then like two, three nonfiction. I'm rereading Timothy Egan's Worst Hard Time, his phenomenal book on the Dust Bowl. I'm finally getting around to reading Say Nothing by Patrick Redden Keefe, all about the Troubles, which is also fantastic. And then there are the books on my Kindle, which I read like when I'm going to sleep because it has its own little nightlight. And so those are different too. Mm-hmm. It depends on the medium. And because of that, it takes me a long time to read anything.
Trust me, I'm the same way. It's like that. That was my physical book up until today. I've got a book on Kindle for my PC that I can kind of have up and read like on breaks or stuff without having to go get anything. I've got the book that's currently up on my Kindle.
Yeah.
And then like, I've got Chirp, Libro, and Audible all on my phone.
Yeah.
And I just rotate through those and listen to, I mean, a lot of times just like the ARCs, I've got the advanced listening copies.
Yeah.
But also like I'm doing a total reread of The Butcher, the Dresden novels.
I've never read those. I've always wanted to read those.
I just decided it's the only series of his that I haven't read everything of.
Yeah.
And like book 19 or something is supposed to come out this year. And I'm like, you know what? I'm going to listen to the whole thing. I've never done it. So
yeah. That reminds me.
I left read. So
yeah. That's good to know. Maybe you'll inspire me to do that. Because that reminds me, I need to get back to reading Dark Tower 3 for my for the deep dive that I'm doing with Neil and Chris Panettiere at Talking Scared. So I also need to be reading Dark Tower 3 for the umpteenth time.
Sorry to remind you about homework.
That's fine. I probably needed it.
All right. Anything before I get to the last two? Anything we haven't talked about that you wanted to mention? It couldn't be about this book, could be about something else.
I should also add that I am very excited and honored to have a story in the upcoming Stand anthology.
I think I saw some about that.
Yeah, it's just this landmark anthology that's going to be phenomenal, of stories that exist in the universe of Stephen King's The Stand. It's the first ever anthology that has kind of been granted that authorial permission to play in his sandbox. And it is like, when I saw the table of contents of all the other contributors, I almost started weeping. I was so honored to be a part of it. It really is just like a who's who of some of the biggest and best horror writers of this generation and the previous generation and the generation before that. It's just a really amazing collection of authors. It's going to be 840 something pages, so it's huge. It really befits The Stand.
It's about as long as The Stand.
Yes. Yeah, it's maybe as long as like the expurgated original publication, but even then it might be a little shorter. But it's gonna be phenomenal. That's another book that I actually am slowly reading on my Kindle because I haven't read other people's stories yet. I'm also going on tour for this book, for When the Wolf Comes Home. The tour dates are starting to be shared on social media. So if anyone wants to see, where I might be, it's gonna be like Pennsylvania and New Jersey and New York City. And, then I'll be going to Phoenix. I'll be going back to Phoenix for the first time for a book event, which will be really fun, and LA and San Diego and Portland, Oregon, and then a few places in between. Hopefully that'll be announced soon. So if you would like to, you know, see me talk about this book in person, I might bring my guitar to some events for some fun things, there'll be signings and all that stuff with some really phenomenal authors as conversation partners. And so look out for those.
You guys are going to be putting people like me out of business. Some of the conversation partners things I've been seeing going around lately.
Who is we it? Got some good ones.
I saw one though the other day and I can't remember. Oh, I think the Abercrombie tour is like, man, I'd like to have half the people on the Abercrombie tour on my podcast, much less Abercrombie.
Jeez. You just got to follow that tour like a deadhead and see who you can peel off.
Is it just like hand up cards? Call me. All right. Curiosity question. You going to Poison Pen or something else?
Poison Pen, yeah.
It is Poison Pen. Okay.
Yeah, very excited.
They usually get the stuff, but I still always, and I know they have everybody, but I always think of them as a mystery bookstore.
Right.
And I've seen almost everybody out there.
Yeah.
All right. And then I'm probably going to... another question I usually ask these days is, you know, do you have a secret talent or something you want to talk about it? But you're an author, you're a musician, a director, a player. We've already gone all through that. So the final question I'll ask you then, and I'll make sure to, by the time this gets posted, we'll have a link down in the description for them. Shout out to a brick and mortar bookstore near you, or just one you want to say something nice about.
Oh, I love that. The challenge will be to only shout out one. And I don't think I will. I will shout out multiple.
Not everybody just shouts out one.
Yeah, because they're too great. I'm really excited about this tour in part because like I get to go to some of my favorite bookstores like Doylestown Bookshop in Pennsylvania, The New York launch is going to be at the Strand, which is, always a dream. I used to work at a brick and mortar bookstore. I was a manager at Shakespeare and Company in, downtown in the Village, in New York. And that has long since closed. There are a couple other, Shakespeare and Companies in Manhattan, but, the Hunter College, location is closing down like as of this week. So shout out to Shakespeare and Company too. There's only like one location left. So people should go visit Shakespeare and Companies whenever they're in Manhattan. Very excited for Poison Pen. I wish I could do an event at Bookman's in Tucson. I love Bookman's. There just wasn't time for a Tucson date. And Changing Hands is also great in Arizona. I get to do a Powell's event, which I'm really excited about. I've always wanted to do a Powell's event. Bookstores are great. I love bookstores. Oh, you know what? The final one I will shout out, just because we were talking about Paradise Valley. Paradise Valley, the area, not Paradise Valley, the weird rich community, but Paradise Valley, the district. When I was growing up on 32nd Street and Bell in North Phoenix, there was a used bookstore that I still have some books from it on my shelves. It was where I got my foundational horror books. They had a great horror section, you know, just with like the little mass markets, and it was, you know, all the same books you would imagine at a great used bookstore in the 90s for the horror section. And that was like really where I got the meat of the genre. And it was a bookstore with just the most exquisite used bookstore name imaginable, called the Tattered Page.
Yeah,
I miss that store. That store was right next door to a used CD store, which was the first job I ever had as a teenager. That place was called CDGB's, and it was just like postered wall to wall and like Zappa posters. And that was just like the most ideal first job a teenager could ever have. But the Tattered Page was a beautiful brick and mortar bookstore that I miss every day.
Man, I'm starting to hate your hair. Every time you say something like that, I forget that you're closer to my age than I think. Oh man, you still got hair. It's dark. Bastard.
Less and less by the day. And after this year, it is getting grayer and grayer. I can share in the spirit of how fun this year has been. I can share one secret talent that I was not expecting to have, which is I can look at a bedpan full of urine and guess the volume of liquid in it within like 10 milliliters. It's a very strange ability that I have learned over the course of the past couple months as a caretaker. So if anyone is in need of some eyeballing of bedpan leavings, don't hit me up. But if you needed to know, I could probably be very accurate.
Probably not the final Jeopardy question, but yeah, that's like,
you never know. You
need those ratings. They're in this pan. Even that would throw the heck out of some people. A trivia game, and then it's like
right. Some weird
spatial math thing. All right. Okay, so I think we're probably going to wrap it up because, again, I've already come close to a spoiler once, but I made sure that it was something that didn't give away something.
You did good. You did real good.
So, but yeah, again, everybody go out, check out this book. You're going to love it. I loved it. Stephen King loved it. Joe Hill loved it. I never say her name right, but like Tana Reeve Du. I probably butchered that. I have to be reading it. I can't just remember it in my head. But yeah, a ton of people have written great things about this book.
You've got who's who
of blurbs on this thing.
Yeah, we are really beyond blessed with blurbs for this book. I'm so, so grateful. And that's another reason why people need to buy as many copies as possible, because a lot of those blurbs came in after the print date. So we need to go into a second printing to be able to have all those blurbs on the book. So just buy up all the books you see. Do me a favor, get them off the shelves.
Yeah, and you remember, if the man doesn't have a full-time job yet, or at the moment. So if he's got to write some more books, which means you need to pay for the one he just wrote.
Yes,
please. That's all I'm saying.
Please.
All right. I'm so hungry. As always, I always appreciate you, Nat. I think we always have a fun time. Thoroughly enjoyed it. I'll also try to get the links down for your tour dates so that whatever that's listed, so people can hopefully see it, where you're going. And that is it. Sorry, you froze up there for a second. It threw me off a little bit.
Oh, no.
Nah, it's one of those things that sometimes you freeze up while we're talking back and forth, but I find that a lot of times the recording is completely fine with it. So
yeah,
it's all good. It's all good. So, you know what? I didn't even ask you. What am I thinking? Are you currently writing something?
I am. I'm late. I'm way late because I haven't been able to get the work done I need to get done this year yet because of all my bedpan magic.
Yeah.
I'm 90,000 words into probably 120,000 word manuscript for my next book that was going to come out next year. Now it's probably going to come out in 2028. Is that right? 2027? What is the next year? 2027. That's right. It's 2025 right now.
Yes.
So it was going to come out in 26, but it'll probably be coming out in 27. So I'm going to try and do what I did last year and see if I can have a novella come out or something like that next year, just to make sure something is coming out every year. But the next novel is close to being done in first draft form. And then it's going to be a long road of rewrites, but I'm going to try and do them as quickly as possible because it's a book that's all about social media and AI and deep fakes and billionaires and horrible tech bros who are, let's say compromising our way of living right now. I really want that out.
A nonfiction writer. That's all I'm saying.
I have literally been working on this book for 9 months, 10 months or something like that. And there are massive set pieces in it that have all started coming true. it's going to seem like I was writing very reactionary stuff. And I was really trying to ooh, what'll happen in a year or two? It's starting to feel more and more nonfiction with every day.
So what you're saying is somebody leaked the manuscript and it's all your fault.
Maybe. it's probably these tech guys in our computers.
All right.
Cool. Alexa did it.
All right. Appreciate it. Hope you have a good one. And I'm going to catch you later.
Thank you, Edward. Thank you for watching and reading.